Welcome to Mr. K's Super Show. I'm Chris Karam, a.k.a. the celebrated Mr. K. And today we're going to talk about four albums that were released in 1971. Yes, folks, 50 years ago. If that doesn't make you feel old, I don't know what will. And in order to talk about these records, I brought on someone who knows a lot about them. And in fact, he is the host of the I'm in Love with That Song podcast, a show where he takes one of his favorite songs, breaks it down, and basically shows you and tells you why it's so great. Of course, I'm referring to Brad Page. Brad, welcome to the show.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
You know, 1971, I mean, if you look back on it, that was a pivotal year in human history. I mean, I think that was the year All in the Family premiered. We were in Vietnam. There was a lot of unrest in the country. I mean, 50 years later, has much changed?
Yeah, well, it's when you look at music is always intrinsically intertwined with the times in which it is created, right? So when you look at, you know, some years, it's very, very clear. 1967, the psychedelic movement had a huge impact on the music, and then the music in turn impacts the culture, and it's kind of this cycle that feeds on itself in a way. 1977 is another year of kind of the same with punk. And though it didn't have a huge impact here, punk is directly linked to the economic conditions in England at the time. I think when you look at 1971, there's not a huge event, you know, a watershed moment. There's no Martin Luther King assassination or an economic collapse or anything like that. It's just sort of a continuation of the political conditions and the social conditions of the previous years. And yet it's an amazing year for music. You could literally take your lunch money or your allowance, or if you were old enough to have a job, you could cash your paycheck and go to the record store every week and buy at least one album that came out that week that is still today considered a classic. And I don't know of any other year, certainly not many, that have produced that many vital classic albums that still stand today as brilliant records. So it's not so much that there was something in the air at the time of a political climate or a political campaign or some big social movement, but for some reason, 1971 really stands out as a year that just produced some amazing records. It's phenomenal when you look at it.
Absolutely. I mean, I was a little too young to appreciate it at the time, but certainly with the passage of time and getting into classic rock and the music of this era, I can certainly appreciate it. And, you know, to a certain degree, the realities of 1971 are reflected, certainly in some of the Black Sabbath lyrics, which we'll get to in a bit. But this was an incredible year. I mean, you consider, you know, Yes had two records out, one of which we'll talk about. Right. We talked about the first one earlier in one of the earlier shows. Why don't we jump in? We're going to do the first album, which is Aqualung by Jethro Tull. This was released March 19th, 1971. Produced by Ian Anderson and Terry Ellis. I am not a huge Jethro Tull fan. I'm mainly like a best of guy or a hits guy, but this is a classic album through and through. It's been referred to as a concept album, but if you look at it, the album, the original vinyl, side one is referred to as Aqualung and side two is referred to as My God. I believe it's more thematic than conceptual. Like I said, I'm not like a huge Tull fan, so I haven't delved into this one maybe lyrically as much as I would have with, say, other bands. You've got Cross-Eyed Mary, you've got Mother Goose, you've got Wondering Aloud. I mean, there's just some great licks here, courtesy of Martin Barr. And of course, you know, Ian Anderson is just kicking ass on his, you know, one-legged flute stance. This is just some great stuff here. And I think Jethro Tull really hit a kind of peak almost, if you will, with this record.
Well, it's certainly a signpost in their career. It's their most commercially successful record by a mile, I would imagine. You are correct in that Ian Anderson has always been adamant that it's not a concept album. It's more of a coincidence almost that the character of Aqualung that pops up in two songs and then the cover artwork of, you know, the bum on the cover and stuff. So it certainly would lead you to think that it's a concept record, but he says that the songs are really not all that connected. There's some general themes. Religion is one he comes back to a few times on the record. It's really just a collection of songs like any other album, but it's a collection of great songs. I did an episode on my podcast on the track My God, which opens side two of the record. It's just some great lyrics, looking at religion. It's one of his flute masterpieces, a real workout. It's eruption for the flute, if you will. Some great guitar. Martin Barr is definitely the MVP of the record. His guitar is so essential. And he's a great player. He's one of those guys that wasn't a spotlight seeker in that sense. I think he always just lived to serve the songs that Ian brought to the table. You know, it's not, I don't think most people look at it as like a Guitar Hero record, but he's great throughout. But it's just, yeah, it's a powerful record. And it certainly broke them in America and in the world, really, in a way that, like I said, it still stands as the record that when people think about Jethro Tull, I think this is absolutely the record they think about. Not necessarily my personal favorite Tull record, but it's certainly one that in the general consciousness, this is Jethro Tull. When you think of them, you think of this record.
Oh, definitely. And I believe, memory serves me correctly, that Yes did their first tour of the U.S. with Tull in this very year. And Johnny Anderson, I was watching a Yes documentary, and John Anderson said he would watch Ian Anderson every night, how he took a certain stance on stage. He would find his spot and just be in that spot all night. And John Anderson was very much a student in that he would look at bands like King Crimson and Tull and think, okay, what are these guys doing that makes them so great and makes them dynamic? And he would incorporate that into Yes and maybe suggest it to the other guys. But I definitely agree with you on Martin Barr. He's just one of those like guitar players who, like you said, served the song. And, you know, in a field where you have a lot of guitar players who just want to show you how great they are, you know, when you get a player like that, it's refreshing because it sort of speaks to a certain craftsmanship and, you know, love of what you do. You know, obviously with Ian Anderson in the band, he was not only like the leader of the band, writing the lyrics and, you know, coming up with the themes, but he was also a focal point because, you know, he kind of looked crazy. He had that big beard and he did that thing where he'd stand on one leg, you know, playing the flute. So, you know, Martin Barr seemed very content to just let Ian do his thing and just bring life to his songs. And, you know, there's some great, you know, of course, Jethro Tull's lineup was always in flux. I don't know if they had a lineup that lasted more than one or two albums a piece, but, you know, there's Clive Bunker on drums and Jeffrey Hammond is playing the bass, which is interesting because you hear Hammond, you think of Hammond organ, but, you know, and of course, Locomotive Breath is on this. Hymn 43 is the song I was referring to earlier. And, you know, it's just an album that's held up very well over the years. Back then, bands made albums. They didn't make collections. Bands like Jethro Tull and the bands, in fact, we're going to talk about on this show, were bands that made albums, not just collections of songs or songs that were just thrown together willy-nilly. They had a cohesiveness. They had a theme. They had motifs. And it was all strung together with, you know, production that really served the material well. And this is, of course, a record that's been reissued and issued many times. And, you know, there's a reason why it's what they call in the business an evergreen.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure we'll talk about it more. I have very strong feelings about the way that people used to make records as opposed to the way they make don't so much now. I think one thing that is consistent across the four albums that we'll talk about today and so many of the other records on that came out in 1971 it's a cliche, but I always fall back on it, is the idea of the record that takes you on a journey, that you start on side one, track one. And by the time you get to the last track on side two, it's taken you on a trip. It hasn't all been one note from the beginning to the end, one tempo, one sound, one rhythm, one groove, whatever, from the beginning to the end. It's taken you through ups and downs and left turns and right turns, and it's a journey and it's an experience. And to me, that makes records all that much more rewarding. And this album certainly does that, from the heaviest moments to some really gentle, quiet, peaceful moments on this record. It's all here.
I couldn't say it better. And unless you have something else to say, Brad, I think we'll move on to our next one.
The only other thing I'd add is, and you mentioned Clive Bunker on drums. He's great on this record. I think Barrymore Barlow is the drummer who's most identified with Tom. Yeah. He came in after this record. So this was the last record, I think, with Clive Bunker. But I guess the second MVP would be Clive's drums. He's pretty phenomenal on this record. But yeah, I mean, again, I would encourage people to go out and, yeah, if you haven't listened to this record in a while, re-listen to it, because if you come at it with fresh ears and don't just listen to the hits,
right?
Yeah, dig a little deeper, and it's a really impressive record. It stands up,
definitely. And you know, you mentioned Clive Bunker on the title track. I mean, he's immortalized with that little drum fill towards the end of the song,
right?
You know, because I've never been in my car sitting playing lap drums, and I've never not tried to replicate that. I don't do it very well, but in spirit, I'm Clive Bunker behind the wheel, as opposed to like Archie Bunker.
Yeah, it's another case of a drummer who's he's playing for the song. He's not overplaying, but he gets some nice little moments to shine. And to me, that's, you can't ask for more than that.
Certainly not. And with that, we're going to move on to our next one. And this album is called Master of Reality. It's by Black Sabbath. It was released on July 21st, 1971, and it was produced by Roger Bain. Boy, Black Sabbath was just riding a wave at this point. I mean, the previous year, they'd had two records out, their debut and this, in the follow-up, Paranoid. And this record just finds them, just like I said, riding that wave, writing songs that address a variety of topics, including the environment, unrest in the, you know, in the country, probably UK, you know, from their point of view. And musically, one of the most notable, I was just listening to this before we started recording, and the thing that I noticed much is that the bass is definitely up in the mix for this record. You can actually hear the bass like bubbling under, and in some cases, you know, in conjunction with Tony Iommi's guitarist. And of course, Tony Iommi is the riff master. I mean, the guy, he's the father of 1,000 riffs. And I mean, it's kind of scary to think where heavy metal would have gone had it not been for Black Sabbath to be among the progenitors of it, and just kind of founding fathers making this sound and showing everybody, this is how you do it, kids. This is how you do it. You can say it's drug influence. You can say it's, you know, Satan influence. Who cares? It's great music. And, you know, the band was just, like I said, riding a wave and in a great space creatively.
Yeah, it's a strong record. It's their third record, right? It followed Paranoid, which is huge for them. But I think maybe it's just that I'm a little overplayed with the tracks from Paranoid, but I like this record a little bit more, I think. Yeah, it's again, you've got a band firing on all cylinders, really consistent, putting out one album after another that hold up. Hard to say there's any weak tracks on those first three Black Sabbath records. And we'll see this again in the records that we're talking about. But man, the pressures on these bands of this time, solo artists and bands of this time, to constantly produce and a tour where you're putting out two albums in a year. I mean, who does that? Look at the last 20, 30 years, and bands typically will have 5 years between albums. Back in the 70s, it was, and 60s, it was, you know, you go out on the road. As soon as you get off the road, you're in the studio, you got 3 weeks to make a record. And then once it's done, you're back out on the road again. And a couple months after that, you're back in the studio to make your second record of the year, push that sucker out, and then you're back on the road again. I mean, it's relentless. And it's amazing in retrospect that any of these bands were able to produce the kind of quality that they did under those pressures. It's really, it's amazing.
I think you have to attribute it to being young and hungry and just not having the clout to be able to say, hey, whoa, whoa, slow down, slow your roll. You know, we'll get it done when we get it done. You know, but you're right. I mean, when you really think about what goes into, you know, writing songs, recording them, it's a, you know, it's, it can be a slog. And especially where these bands are just being pushed out there by the record companies, by management, the promoters want them. Be careful what you wish for, you may get it. And, you know, a band like Black Sabbath, you got to hit while the iron's hot. We were doing our last episode, we were talking about this same thing about bands putting out a record every year. And one example I found was Journey. And I read that, like, when they were at their, in their heyday, they literally would spend 9 months on the road and then go into the studio for the other 3 months. It was like year in, year out, just a cycle. And even if you're young and you've got a lot of energy, I imagine at some point it's got to wear on you.
Oh, sure.
Right. I mean, obviously, Black Sabbath are no strangers to drugs. They certainly, you know, popularized them in a sense. I mean, the song Sweet Leaf starts off with Tony Iommi coughing after taking a hit off a joint. And it's kind of one of those things because it's him coughing, but they processed it like with an effect and then just went right into that doomy, sludgy riff. And, you know, back then bands did stuff like that. You would just take some, you know, you'd capture something on tape that wasn't meant to be heard by the general public and you'd throw it into a song. And, you know, Sweet Leaf was obviously extolling the virtues of marijuana for, you know, the potheads back then. And, you know, ultimately over time, pot would prove to be the least of Black Sabbath's problems, but it made for a great song. I mean, you've got tracks like, say, After Forever, which was written solely by Tony Iommi. Most of the Black Sabbath songs are credited, you know, to the entire band. It's kind of like a publishing thing.
Yeah.
But this song was written solely by Tony because he wanted to kind of write a song that affirmed his faith because, of course, Black Sabbath were getting accused of being, you know, devil worshipers and all this other stuff, which, I mean, I don't buy that at all. I think if they were embracing, you know, the Satan thing, it was more of a theatrical conceit. Just to sort of, you know, get people to listen. I mean, you know, obviously they had giant inverted crosses live, but, you know, I mean, I don't think the fans really cared about that. It's, but of course, like the people in the Bible Belt, the Moral Majority and the, you know, the doom and gloom people are like, oh, these, you know, these bands are corrupting our youth. It's like, trust me, they're being corrupted by much stronger stuff. I mean, you know, back then, as is now, sadly, you know, we still have rampant drug use in this country. And, you know, back then it was considered more of a recreational thing, probably a little, maybe looser attitudes amongst, like, say, the younger people and the hippie set. But, you know, Sabbath were kind of delving into that, both in terms of their, you know, personal experimentation, their lyrical content. One of the great things, Brad, I've said many times before on this show, the great bands did not do just one kind of music on a record. You know that.
Exactly.
For example, there's a song on this album called Solitude, which is has no drums, no keyboards. It's just this slow, moody song where he's singing about feeling worthless and, you know, my fortune means nothing. And to the point where I wasn't even sure it was Ozzy the first time I heard it. I mean, and Black Sabbath would do that. They would just throw in one of these slow, moody songs that really didn't have like a driving riff or a pounding beat. And it made for interesting listening because you'd start off heavy, you'd keep it heavy, then you'd slow it down. There's a couple of short instrumentals. One's called Embryo and the other's called Orchid. And I think they're there probably just to fill space because, you know, this record, I think, was probably at best, you know, yeah, it's 34 minutes. So, you know, when you're on the road and you're just knocking stuff out, you know, sometimes you're going to have to write a filler track. And, you know, we all know that even the best albums have at least one or two filler tracks.
I guess it depends on how flexible you are on a filler track. I mean, what's kind of throwaway to some people is essential to others.
Exactly.
I mean, I'm pretty flexible on those kind of things. A lot of things that people might think is just a filler track, sometimes those are maybe not my favorite in the record, but they're up there just because they're interesting. They're not the formula. Those are typically the moments when the bands maybe step a little bit outside their comfort zone, do something a little bit different. It might not be the thing that you would pick out to listen to by itself, but the point is that it's on a record. Like you were talking about before, about bands making albums. They were making an experience, a 34-minute experience is what this record's supposed to be. It's not supposed to be a collection of hit singles. It's not a greatest hits thing. It's, you know, this is where we're at this point in time as a band. This is what we want to say, or this is what we're feeling, or this is just what we're enjoying doing. That's a It's that, again, it's that journey that a record takes you on.
Exactly. I mean, even like the early Beatle records essentially were just a collections of songs. Obviously, as the Beatles' career progressed, they started to make records and they started to sequence them and mix them in a way that signified that, okay, this is not just a collection of songs thrown together willy-nilly. And obviously, Black Sabbath, they were never that band. They've never been that band. They have always, you know, had a sort of cohesiveness, you know, when their work was really strong. Like most bands, of course, at some point, you know, you start to lose your way, but they weren't losing their way at this point. They were very strong and on point. You have like Tony Iommi, like I said, the Riffmaster, Geezer Butler, easily one of the great bassists of all time. Bill Ward, who's got a very unusual drum style, he actually said in an interview many years back that he considers himself a percussionist, not a drummer. And that he, unlike most drummers, he doesn't lock in with the bass and just play like in the background. He plays to the vocal. And when I listen to, especially this early stuff, like, you know, Master Reality, I can hear that. He's playing in a very unorthodox way. I don't think he's a school musician. And, you know, sometimes, like in the case of Eddie Van Halen, sometimes I think some musicians are better off not being schooled. Because they don't know the rules, so they don't worry about the rules. They just play however they play, and they don't think, gee, I can't play this chord, or I can't play in this key or this chord progression. Sometimes it's just the best players are the instinctive players who just go for it and they kind of, you know, extemporize and just are in the moment.
Yeah, certainly when you're talking about music like this, it's all about the feel and the attitude. And that's not to say that these guys aren't skilled. I don't think a rich musical education would help Tommy Iommi write better riffs. You know what I mean? That's not the source of it. It's just his unique vision and his experience and his limitations. And he has some limitations, physical limitations, but that's all goes into making his sound
Right. And you've got Ozzy Osbourne. Is Ozzy Osbourne technically a great singer? You know, probably not if you want to rate him on pure technical terms, but he has such a unique voice. You hear Ozzy open his mouth and you're not wondering who it is. I've never confused Ozzy with any other singer. He's got a singular voice, a singular way he attacks the vocals or attacks the lyrics, I should say. Here's a guy who, by all rights, probably should have died years ago. But, you know, he's defied the odds. He's had probably a bigger solo career than he did with Black Sabbath. But he's, you know, gone back and forth between the two for the last couple of decades. You listen to this 50 years later, like I was listening to it earlier, and it still holds up. It's fresh. There's nothing dated about it, which is I can't say that about some other 70s albums or even some 80s albums, by that matter. I mean, this is 34 minutes, but it's concise, it's tight, and, you know, it doesn't overstay its welcome. Unlike, I think one byproduct we got from the CD era was that bands felt this need all of a sudden now to make 70-minute albums, and that always didn't work out.
Yeah, exactly. Once bands started to discover that you could fit 70 minutes worth of music on a CD, you know, just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Right.
And there's a lot of that. I mean, there's some great long records, but for the most part, that's one of the things that makes the records of the 70s and the 60s so much more concise, because they were limited by how much they could physically put on a record. You can't do really much more than 40 minutes without the sound quality suffering in some way. The closer to 30 minutes you get, the better sounding the record is. And sure, that's a limitation, but it also meant you had to pick your best material.
Right. You had to distill it down to its essence. You know, you right. couldn't really put, I mean, obviously bands like Chicago didn't really fit into that because their first few records were doubles. But yeah, I mean, when you're limited to 35, 40 minutes, okay, we've got to keep it to its essence. And it probably kept some really duff tracks from ending up on some of these records.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, when you think about it now, when a lot of these things get reissued on CD, as they have been for the last 30 plus years, inevitably there's extra bonus tracks on every CD. You know what I mean? When you go you buy the reissue of this record, for example, I don't remember, but I would bet there's some bonus tracks on it. And those are typically, you know, it's cool to hear, but I can't really think of very many times at all where there's been a bonus track, you know, an outtake that you say, oh, I wish that was on the record, you know?
Right.
They're almost always, it's kind of clear why they didn't end up on the record. And they don't necessarily add a whole lot to the record. So that self-forced self-editing was a good thing.
There is a deluxe version of this CD that came out about 10 years ago. And there is a second disc with some outtake versions, some alternate lyric versions. And, you know, in all honesty, I've listened to it once, maybe twice, but I go back to the original more than anything. There's some curiosities. Like I said, there's, you know, Sweet Leaf with, I don't think the lyrics had been written. I think Ozzy was just, you know, coming up with stuff on the spot because they didn't make any sense. It's fun to listen to. It's, you know, you get to hear a different guitar solo on one song, or you hear it a different way. But like you said, there's nothing on that bonus CD that's making me go, damn, that should have been on the record. I think Master of Reality as it stands is perfect. I mean, it's what it needs to be. And I don't know what else to say about it, really.
Yeah, when you've got those extra tracks, they're fun when you're a hardcore fan to hear that stuff. But when you step back and take a look at it, like I said, it's very, very rare that any of those bonus tracks, unreleased tracks, would have made the records any better. They made the right decisions at the time.
Absolutely. And with that, we're going to move on to our next album, Led Zeppelin IV, released on November 8th, 1971, produced by Jimmy Page. Now, this record technically does not have a title. It's been referred to, some fans refer to it as Four Symbols. A lot of people call it Zozo or Zofo. I think most Led Zeppelin fans refer to it as Led Zeppelin IV. I always have. Mm-hmm. This album really didn't have much of an impact on music, so we're just going to skip to the next one.
You could do a whole show on this.
I almost did. And maybe I will, you know, but Led Zeppelin IV is just one of those albums. It's my favorite Led Zeppelin record, and it's probably the one that's most responsible for some of the most overplayed classic rock songs of all time, to the point where at one point I couldn't listen to this record. Mm-hmm. It was too overdone. But when you listen to it, like you say, listen to it with a fresh set of ears and really immerse yourself in it. This was Led Zeppelin at their absolute peak. They were on fire musically. They were creating music that, you know, built on, you know, it wasn't like a bunch of heavy rock cliches. You have acoustic music, you have bluesy music, you've got, you know, stuff like Four Sticks, where, you know, John Bonham literally is playing with four sticks at a time, two in each hand. And of course, you know, we have to mention, of course, the rock and roll national anthem. And no, I'm not referring to Rock and Roll All Night. I'm going to refer to, of course, to Stairway to Heaven, which, is it overplayed? Yes. Some people feel it's overrated. I don't agree with that. But if you just listen to it, like I said, a fresh set of ears, any of these songs, you're going to hear a rock and roll masterpiece. That Stairway to Heaven alone takes you on a journey, you know, starting off with very soft acoustic playing, some, you know, some keyboard in the background. And then all of a sudden the drums kick in, Page is on fire with the guitar. I mean, you know, what can you say about a song like Stairway to Heaven that hasn't been said already, Brad?
Yeah, I mean, and this whole record, really, because it's been so covered. But yeah, it was a culmination of everything Zeppelin had learned up until that time. You've got the heaviness from the first two records, the more acoustic approach to the third record. That all comes together on this album, just to give you the best of everything. And I think we've all had that experience with this record where we get sick of it just because of the radio. It always frustrates me when, you know, people say, oh, I'm sick of that song, I hate this song. It's no, you don't. What you're sick of is what radio has done to these records. You know, I have no great love for radio. You know, turn the radio off and go buy some CDs or albums or whatever and put those on and experience the music the way it was meant to be experienced. You know, when Rock 101 or whatever this local station is going to have a block of Led Zeppelin, you already know what three songs they're going to play, right? When they have a block of Bad Company or whoever, it's always the same damn three songs. And, you know, these bands deserve so much better than that. So don't let radio ruin your love for this music. Turn the radio off. Put your iPod on random, whatever it is, and just listen to all the other stuff in the catalogs of these bands that really stands up. And I mean, you want to talk about an album that takes you on a journey from track one to the last track. I mean, this record absolutely does it. It's an experience. It is one of those great turn the lights off, put the headphones on, you know, lay in your bed at night and let the music take you someplace. I don't know if people do that anymore, if kids do that anymore, but we certainly did that when we were younger, right? It was, yeah. Have a really crappy day at school. You come home, you turn the lights off in your room, you put your headphones on and you turn the speakers up loud if your parents will let you, and you just let that music take you away. And this is an album that can do that. Just every member of the band shines on this record from start to finish. And yes, Stairway to Heaven is kind of a rock and roll cliche, but maybe the finest guitar solo ever. So great. Jimmy Page's solo on this, it's like a conversation with God. It's that good.
Wow.
It's so good.
Classic rock radio reduces every band, especially bands like Led Zeppelin, to basically five songs. And yeah. Stairway to Heaven is one of them. Black Dog, Whole Lot of Love, you know, Cashmere. And right. Like you said, bands like, especially like Led Zeppelin, you really want to get the records and listen to them in the sequence that they're mixed in and mastered in, because those records were made that way for a purpose. Jimmy Page, you know, I'm generally of the opinion that most artists should not produce themselves, but Jimmy Page is one of the exceptions to that rule. He knew what he wanted, and he made sure that, like, the records were sequenced a certain way for maximum impact. I mean, you start off with Black Dog, and there's this weird kind of sound, which I believe is like a tuning thing that's going on. And then it just, Robert Plant does this, you know, kind of a cappella vocal where he's just belting it out. And then the band kicks in. And it's just one of those identifiable riffs. And, you know, Brad, you were right on point when you said everybody in this band was firing on all cylinders. I mean, Led Zeppelin was one of those bands where you take any one person out of that lineup and it would have a major detriment to the sound and the band.
Absolutely.
You know, I never realized it initially when I started listening to Zeppelin, but over the years, I've really come to the conclusion that John Paul Jones was the secret weapon for that band.
In many ways, yes.
Yeah. I mean, he didn't attract attention to himself. He was perfectly content to write sometimes, arrange, play keyboards, play bass, and leave the showboating to Page and Plant, and to a certain degree, Bonham. Mm-hmm. He was perfectly suited to that band, both musically and temperamentally. You know, he's one of those guys who, you know, since Zeppelin has just kind of done a lot of production work and, you know, occasionally has put some music out. But I mean, you know, you've got rock and roll, which is, you know, just basically a kind of old school sort of rock and roll type riff with rollicking piano, but, you know, kind of done with Zeppelin's panache. You've got Battle of Evermore, which is sort of like this, you know, almost medieval Dungeons and Dragons sounding thing, but it's great. Misty Mountain Hop, which has these real kind of weird hippie lyrics. Four Sticks, like I mentioned before, where it's probably my least favorite track on the album, but it's still a very interesting song where John Bonham is literally playing with two sticks in each hand. And Bonham was known for playing with big drumsticks. So who am I to argue? And then Going to California, which had a kind of Joni Mitchell folk influence. And of course, the epic album closer When the Levee Breaks, which really revolutionized drum sound. You know, all of a sudden they realized you don't have to have drums that sound like cardboard boxes or that sound flat. If you put the mics a certain distance away, I believe the story that I read, they recorded this album at a mansion called Headley Grange in England.
Yes.
And as I understand it, Bonham was recording in a hallway and they had microphones snaked over the stairway above him. They were recording him from like distance. And Jimmy Page was notorious for saying distance is depth. He never, ever mic'd drums like close mic. Like he put them right up to the kick drum. He would, you know, having them a few feet away. And you listen to, say, like I said, When the Levee Breaks, Bonham is just, it's a tour de force. So much so that I think it's one of the most sampled drum riffs, yeah, or drum licks by rap bands, you know. And I mean, you think about it, it's the perfect rap beat. It's got, it's heavy, it's menacing. And I can see why, you know, some hip hop artists would seize on that. Great song, you know, and the conclusion to an album that, like you say, this just takes you on a journey. Slap on the headphones, turn out the lights, crank that mother up and just go for it.
Yeah, it really is. It's just a fantastic record that, and I'll say it again, I probably, no one out listening to this podcast is unfamiliar with this record, but it's so worth revisiting in a way when you have the time to do it and the space to do it. You know, not when you're working on your car, doing the dishes or whatever, but when you have the time to sit and really listen to it on a half decent stereo, and just all of, there's so many subtle and interesting sounds, right from the very top, as you mentioned, that opening effect sound in the front of Black Dog, which, yeah, that was just sort of the messing around. It's kind of an echo, like an Echoplex tape machine.
Yeah.
What, but it's a creepy sound. Mm. And to open your record that way, it's kind of a little statement in and of itself, right through When the Levee Breaks, which is a standard, basically a standard, you know, 12 bar blues type of thing. But if you listen to every cycle of those 12 bars, there's almost something new, some new sound added each time around. That song evolves and expands over the however long it is, 7 minutes or something like that.
I forget. Yeah, something like that, 8 minutes.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's easy to think of, you know, blues songs as, oh, it's just three chords and ad infinitum. But that track alone is a journey. Plus, then you put Stairway to Heaven on top of it. You put the mood setting of Battle of Evermore, going to California, and just all of it. It's just worth listening to again. Go back and listen to this record, folks. It's so good. Yep.
You know, if you put any two Led Zeppelin records back to back, they don't sound alike.
Right.
Jimmy Page was notorious for, okay, the last album, you know, had a certain sound. They'd bring in different engineers or new people or try different, experiment with different recording techniques. There was never, ever, okay, we did this sound on our last record. It was a big hit, so let's just do more of the same. I have to imagine some of the executives at Atlantic Records had to have been going, don't mess with the formula, Jimmy. You know, you guys are a hit. But that's what made Zeppelin what they were. They were never content to rest on their laurels. I mean, every album has its own distinctive sound, its own distinctive tone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a reflection of where they were and who they were at the time, and, you know, maybe what was going on in their lifestyles and their perception of things. But yeah, I mean, this album to me, it's just, I think a lot of people would probably agree, or at least I can think of one or two, that this was Zeppelin pretty much reaching their peak. And that's not to say they wouldn't release some great records after this, because they certainly would. I mean, I contend to this day that Led Zeppelin never made a bad record. There's not one album in their catalog where I go, oh yeah, this sucks, or this one's kind of a lame. No, I mean, this is just, to me, the probably, you know, it's funny, like, we did Physical Graffiti on one of our earlier episodes, and I think Physical Graffiti is probably the album that represents them the best in terms of, like, the diversity of their catalog and their musical styles. But I would argue that this record right here is them just their most cohesive statement, and probably their best in terms of just the playing, the songwriting, the arranging, everything that they were putting onto those, you know, two sides of vinyl.
Yeah, and I love Physical Graffiti too. That's one of my favorites. It's so hard to pick a favorite Zeppelin record, but yeah, at certain times, that's been my favorite Zeppelin record. Interesting that, and going back to when we were talking about leftover tracks, bonus tracks, there was a few tracks on the actual Physical Graffiti record that were cut and left off of Zeppelin 4.
Yep.
that were then eventually they figured, well, we ought to use these somewhere. And they ended up on the Physical Graffiti record. Yeah. And I don't think this record would have been any stronger if they had put them on this record. This record is perfect the way it is. I would agree that Four Sticks is generally probably most people's least favorite song on the record. It's just maybe a notch or two below the other tracks. And still, you know, when you're talking about a song that's not quite as good as Black Dog or Stairway to Heaven or When the Levee Breaks, you're still talking about a pretty damn good song. So yeah, this record is about as perfect as a record could be.
If you get the most recent deluxe CD reissue, there's a bonus CD where they were actually doing Four Sticks with a Bombay orchestra. And it's kind of interesting. It's different. It's not like, again, it's not a song that I've listened to a ton, but it is interesting to hear them do it with Indian, I believe it's Indian musicians. Mm-hmm. And I'd heard about these recordings for years. And I guess Jimmy figured, well, you know, this is probably the last hurrah for Led Zeppelin reissues because, you know, he's getting up there in age. So, they put together a series of CD reissues where they had bonus CDs. And if you really like Led Zeppelin 4, I'd recommend it because, you know, there's an interesting version called of When the Levee Breaks. And it's different because you can definitely hear it. It definitely sounds like a rehearsal version or a demo version. But it's interesting, like, it doesn't have that big thwack drum sound that Andy Johns, the engineer, gave John Bonham. But, you know, you don't expect that from, a rehearsal, a demo or whatever.
Yeah. Again, when we talk about alternate takes and B-sides and things like that, I mean, they're all interesting to listen to. And if you're a hardcore fan, you should check them out. I splurged and got the that massive box set of this album. That's a great package, and worth a listen. But you can't beat the original side one, side two of this record. It's just perfect the way it is. But yeah, that alternate take that they recorded in Morocco or wherever it was is really interesting. And they, when Page and Plant reunited to do the MTV Unplugged and that Unleaded tour they did after that, that was one of the songs they featured in the set, was a version of Four Sticks. And that was interesting too. That we're a little bit of a off detour here, but I love that record.
We one thing about the show is we detour a lot. We zigzag. There's no rules. You can go off on a tangent, and we always end up coming back to the main topic. So don't worry about that, Brad.
Yeah, well, it may be a little bit of a tangent from 1971, but certainly okay. Talking about Led Zeppelin, the Unleaded record, the MTV Unplugged is fantastic. The way they re-envisioned a lot of these songs is really interesting. I'm not sure they're necessarily better than the originals, but I would say some of them are. I have a hard time choosing sometimes which one I like more. So anyway, that's worth a listen to.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, they could have just basically done the hits or done them with the original arrangements and the original style, and it still would have sold. It was the reuniting of Page and Plant. The fact that they wanted to kind of put a different spin on it, I think speaks well. Like, we're not just going to rehash these songs like you heard them. We're going to try different arrangements. We're going to take a different approach. And I think that really speaks to what Led Zeppelin was all about, taking each album as an individual project. Okay, let's try this. Let's do that. Let's record this way. Jimmy Page, and you're a guitar player, right, Brad?
Yes.
Jimmy Page was notorious for alternative tunings.
Yep.
I mean, he was just like, okay, let's tune, the G string to A and blah, blah, blah. But you know what? You can't argue with the results, especially with a record like this.
Yeah, all throughout his career, throughout those Zeppelin records, there's all kinds of really unusual tunings that turn up. He was a visionary guitar player. Yeah, he could be sloppy. He could be sloppy live sometimes. None of that bothers me, just because he's just, his particularly his arranging skills and his songwriting skills, it's unparalleled. There's few guitar players have done that. Jeff Beck, Eric Clapton, Jimi Hendrix, they all have the things that made them unique. To me, what makes Jimmy really special is not just his ability to make some killer solos, but his ability to both compose and to arrange is really, really a gift.
Definitely. I mean, you can, as you get older and you have a more of a knowledge of music, you can really appreciate that kind of craft, because it probably, I don't think it exists to the degree it did back then. I think that says it all, really. So let's move on to our fourth and final album, Fragile by Yes. This album was released on November 26, 1971 in the UK, but didn't see a US release until January 4th, 72. You know what? Who cares? It came out in 71 in the UK. That's good enough for me.
Right. It was made in 71 and officially released in 71. Just didn't quite make it out in the US, but it's a 1971 record through and through. Yeah, I was just going to say, we had talked about this before, but this is Yes's second album of the year.
Yes.
Because the Yes album, which is a brilliant album in and of itself, in their first album with Steve Howe on guitar, less than a year later, they go back in the studio, this time with a new keyboard player.
Oh, yes.
Rick Wakeman makes his first appearance on this record. So you've got, you know, a guitar player who's been in the band less than a year, at least in terms of, you know, the recording side of it. You've got a keyboard player who's new to the band, and they record their second masterpiece of the year. I mean, who does that?
No.
It's amazing.
I mean, Yes is a band. I mean, talk about like a really eclectic mix of musicians. I mean, you've got Bill Bruford, who's basically a jazz guy. You've got John Anderson, who's into vocal groups. You've got Chris Squire, who's heavily influenced by, like, you know, Jack Bruce, and obviously has a singular style. Steve Howe, who can play pretty much any stringed instrument he damn well wants to and does. Mm-hmm. And now you have Rick Wakeman, who is one of these classically trained, very flamboyant, flashy players. But it's a real kick in the pants. I mean, you know, Yes, I feel like Yes, 71 was the year that Yes really kind of came into their own, and that started with the Yes album, and it just goes further with this record.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, come on, Heart of the Sunrise, Roundabout, I mean, South Side of the Sky. You know, this is a band that's just experimenting with musical sound forms and just saying, we're going to do whatever we damn well want. I mean, what's interesting about this record, and to some degree, it's a little bit of a detriment. They also, there's four main tracks on this album, and then there are these five quote-unquote solo tracks to varying degrees of quality. But at the same time, a lot of bands wouldn't do that. They wouldn't have like showcase tracks for each member of the band. But Yes is a band of virtuosos, which practically demands that you have a Steve Howe acoustic guitar piece, a Rick Wakeman piece, although he didn't write it, though. I think it was contractually he couldn't write. I think he might have been still in a contract for his previous band. I mean, then you've got Chris Squire doing The Fish, where it's all bass. It's all bass riffs, you know, played in different, you know, like there's a lead bass riff. Chris Squire, you know, and I'm sure you know this, Brad, Chris Squire was not a guy who was plunking along in the background, keeping the beat, I mean, keeping the rhythm. He was a lead player. He was essentially a guitar player who played on the bass. I mean, and, you know, sometimes there's a bit of a cacophony of sound because you've got all these guys going for it at the same time. But generally speaking, and on this record, they give each other space to shine. Like, okay, Steve, you do this guitar part. Okay, Rick, Steve, you quiet down. Rick, you come in and, you know, Roundabout. I mean, again, one of those songs that's been played to death by classic rock radio, but you listen to it and, you, like I said, with fresh ears, it's just a wonder of songcraft, playing, and musicianship. I mean, everything here, this is just one of those albums, like you said, it's their second masterpiece. Who does that? Who releases two masterpieces in the same damn year? Right.
How do you manage to do that? And with the shuffling of the personnel,
yeah,
you would think that would be impossible. And yet, you know, these two records prove us otherwise, but it's just, yeah, it's self-indulgent. All prog rock is self-indulgent, yes, to some degree. And when you get to the point where you're giving each band member their little showcase, okay, it could be self-indulgent. But you got to figure, you know, Steve Howe's Mood for a Day is my favorite of the five solo pieces on here.
That's great.
It's a really nice guitar instrumental. It's less than 3 minutes long. All the others are even shorter than that. You know, Rick Wakeman's classical piece is about a minute and a half. So it's not like you have to sit through lengthy, self-indulgent, less than pieces of music. You know, I go back and I think of something like Pink Floyd's Umagumma, where they it's a two record set where one set was a live double, you know, two sides live, and then sides three and four were, you know, each band member got some time to kind of create something of their own. And none of those things are any good. I love Pink Floyd, but sides three and four of Umagumma are not very good. Here, each band member really says their piece in a nice, tight, concise form, yeah, and then they get on with it. And so it doesn't drag the record down. The album is still, those little pieces basically just serve to kind of, they're like the after dinner mint or the, you know, the refreshment between act one and act two, you know, Roundabout, South Side of the Sky, Long Distance Runaround, Heart of the Sunrise, or those are the four corners, the four legs, if you will, of this chair, and provide a really solid foundation for a great record. The other bits and pieces in there, some are better than others, but none of them are terrible. None of them drag the record down. It's a really strong record. And just thinking of it now, of the, looking at all four of the records that we've talked about here, all four of them feature a really unique, distinctive vocalist.
Yep.
Who could not be mistaken for anybody else. I mean, Ian Anderson, totally his own thing. Ozzy, totally his own thing. Robert Plant is, basically created a genre of vocal stylists. And John Anderson doesn't, you know, there's really no one else in rock who sounds like him. None of these four could even, you know, make the preliminary rounds on American Idol, which tells me everything I need to know about American Idol.
That's right.
I have no time for that nonsense. These are singers with their own unique voice and something to say and their own way to deliver it. You know, you can't really even compare them. How do you compare Ozzy and John Anderson? I mean, they're not even in the same, I don't know that, you know what I mean? Just completely different approaches in every way. And yet iconic in their own way. That's something that we miss today. There's so, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I'm an old fart, but when I listen to a lot of new rock, new music, so much of it, like the guitar playing and the vocals, that they all sound interchangeable. It's so rare that you have somebody who really cannot be mistaken for anybody else. And on these four records, you've got that.
Right. And Fragile brings also something into the mix, so to speak, that the previous three Yes albums didn't have. A new artist by the name of Roger Dean did the cover art. And, you know, you, Brad, you remember, I mean, back in the 70s and the 80s and probably the 60s too, you would sometimes buy a record just based on the cover art. And yes, especially when Roger Dean came on board and started doing these, you know, kind of surrealist, you know, dreamscape type things, it gave Yes their own logo, for one thing, their very distinctive logo, but it also gave them very distinctive album covers that kind of jumped out at you from the record racks. And, you know, that's an important thing, because you want a record that's going to like attract someone's attention just for the visual aspect of it. And if they like it enough, they might just take a chance on it. Now, with Yes, you were getting Fragile. And of course, it's a picture of the Earth. So they were, Yes was making their own little, you know, environmental statement. Of course, Yes were a bunch of, you know, hash smoking hippies at the time. And, you know, who were known for being vegetarians and wanting to save the Earth and everything, which is, you know, nothing wrong with that. But they could incorporate very unorthodox sound, very unorthodox song structures, musicianship, you know, where every guy has a very distinctive style, but yet you mix it all together on a recording console and somehow cohesiveness comes out of it. They were creating riffs and textures that other bands weren't doing. I mean, that's probably true of every record on this that we've talked about on this show. They're just not making these type of records, and they're not writing these type of songs. There's a sort of a level of song craft and imagination where I think like these bands just were blessed or lucky to have a certain kind of freedom where they didn't have, or at least not that I knew of, record labels breathing down their necks telling them to record commercial tracks. You know, back then, I think if you were a band like this and you sold a certain amount of records, and I think the record companies would just leave them alone. They weren't trying to tackle these bands like singles bands. They were targeting, in fact, Led Zeppelin was notorious for targeting radio as an album band. They didn't want, they released very few singles in the US. Stairway to Heaven was never a single, kids. And, you know, Fragile, there is a single mix of Fragile, but it's like a 4-minute, like hacked up atrocity.
Yeah.
Don't listen to that. You know, if it comes on the radio, find a station that's playing the full length version, or just go out and buy the damn record yourself. Right. Fragile, it's like I said, you've got a little bit of indulgence, but it's kept in check. It's not like going to a Yes concert where you'd have to listen to Steve Howe play for 10 minutes or Rick Wakeman noodle away for, you know, 10 minutes or whatever. They kept it to the point because, you know, like we said, you were dealing with the 40-minute record and you didn't really want to go too far over that because, you know, sound quality would suffer. And of course, with bands like all of these bands, really, you know, sound quality was key. Wanted these records to have a distinctive sound and tone. And that's a reason why I think 50 years later, we're still listening to this stuff. It resonates with us. It's stuff that you can go back to. It's what, you know, it's what it's referred to in the industry as an evergreen. And these records have all sold in very significant numbers. I believe all of these records have gone at least platinum. I mean, with Zeppelin IV, it's probably like 10 times. It's probably like a diamond award. I haven't looked it up, but I can't imagine Led Zeppelin IV having sold anything less than 5 million copies. But Fragile, yeah, it's just, here they are, second album of the year. They're bringing in a new guy, and yet it just goes from strength to strength. I mean, the band doesn't miss a beat. They just take it to the next level. And that's what Yes always did, especially in these early records, the first, you know, 5 or 6 Yes records. Each one was like, let's take what we did the last time and let's go further with this. Let's experiment. What kind of band is doing that kind of musical experimentation these days, you know?
Talking about record sales, Led Zeppelin IV, 23 times platinum.
Yeah.
23 million records over its history. Masters of Reality, I believe, was 2 times platinum. No small stakes there. Same with Fragile. And Aqualung, I believe, was maybe 3 times platinum. So these multi-million copies of all of these records that we've talked about here sold, and chart success. I mean, Fragile, I made it to number four on Billboard's top 200. I mean, just think about that. This is not anyone's definition of pop music.
No.
Right?
Most definitely not.
3.5-minute single. And yet people had the state of mind, the interest to go out and buy records like this by the millions. It wasn't a cult following. It was literally millions of people buying records like Yes, Fragile. To me, it boggles the mind today to think about what makes the charts and sells today compared to, you know, what was making charts in the 70s. It's just weird. And I don't know how to put my finger on it, but it's this combination of the artists, the record companies, and the audience, and what they were all willing to give and take at the time. And it's tightened up so much now where, you know, it's the bands, it's the record companies, it's the fans. Going back to Zeppelin IV, and Led Zeppelin has always been thought of as a hard rock band, an early heavy metal band. Some people would dispute that one way or another. I don't really care, but Zeppelin at its heaviest is definitely heavy. Mm. And yet they could do something like Battle of Evermore. And you look at bands post 1990, what they were allowed to do by their audience or what they let themselves do. And it became so much more siloed. The slice of the pies gets cut smaller and smaller, where it's not enough to be a heavy metal band. Now you have to be a black metal band, which is different than a death metal band.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like people, bands started to put themselves more and more into these narrow slices of genres and cutting it the pie finer and into smaller and smaller slices. And I guess if you only like one kind of music, that's okay, because you know exactly what you're going to get when you buy one of those records. But I would think, as an artist, that's so limiting. I would think, as a record label, you're limiting your potential audience. And as a fan, like, come on, who wants to eat pizza every day? I love pizza. Yeah, but after a week of eating pizza morning, noon, at night, like, don't you want something else?
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
I keep going back to it, but it's the idea of these records, the great records of the 60s, 70s, into the 80s, took you on a journey where you could have something as heavy as Black Dog and as something as quote unquote wimpy as Going to California. And nobody yelled at you about it. You know, fans didn't say you were a sellout because you didn't do it. And the record label didn't say, what's this crap? Go back to your heavy shit. And as a band member, you weren't afraid to do it because you weren't afraid of what your audience would do. You gave them what you wanted to give them and your audience ate it up. And how do we get to the point today where music is so generic? There's a lot of reasons why you can kind of figure it out, but it's too much to tackle in this podcast. But ultimately,
maybe it's just a shame. Maybe the next time you come on, we can kind of expand on that premise. But, you know, I think basically you had record companies. Look, record companies have always been big business entities.
Of course.
They're in it to make money. But I think back then it was less corporate. It was more like, okay, these guys know what they're doing. These guys have a sound. Let's just let them do their thing. As long as we make money, that's all we care about. I mean, you had like Atlantic Records, which was run by Ahmet Erdogan, who started out as a jazz and blues musician. So you had people who, like, in some cases were musicians, but they understood music and they had like empathy or sympathy for these artists. Let them do their thing. I think what happened, you know, especially with a lot of veteran bands in the 80s, when the 70s had this explosion with record sales, and it's partially due to records like this. And all of a sudden you started getting lawyers, Harvard MBAs, people like, hey, you can make money in this industry. And everything was based now on, well, your last record sold X amount of units, so we want you to do this. We're going to give you songwriter X and producer Y. And, you know, to some degree, it yielded success. And I think music became more corporatized. And like you said, everything has to be put inside a box. And, you know, what is Led Zeppelin? Are they a heavy metal band? Are they a jazz rock band? Are they a folk band? A little bit of everything. And that can be said almost for every band here. Black Sabbath is probably the one that's probably most defined by the term heavy metal, but even a song like Solitude, that's not heavy. It's a ballad. Right. It's not even really a traditional ballad. So kids, dig out any one or all of these records, listen to it, embrace it, let it seep into your mind and your pores and your heart, and it's not going to let you down.
Yeah. And I'll just say, you know, one more thing on that. And it ties back into the fact that we're talking about 1971, because we're fresh out of the 60s. The 70s are just getting started. And like you said, at the beginning, the balance of art and commerce, still not talking about, you know, top 40 radio, which there's always been crap. Right. In the history of pop music, you could always say, I don't know what the percentage is, but let's say when you're looking at the top 40, pick a year, 1962, 1978, 1982, whatever it is, pick a year, look at the charts, and you'll say most of it is crap. The stuff that made the charts, it's, you know, stuff that was not meant to last. But that aside, the music industry, I think, coming out of the 60s into the 70s, still the balance of art and commerce still leaned more towards art. The scales were heavier on the art side. By the time we come out of the 70s, at the end of the decade, that's pretty much flipped. Because like you said, people started seeing there was big money in rock and roll, in tours, in merchandise, in record sales. There was, people were paying attention above and beyond people like Ahmet Erdogan, who just genuinely loved music. There was money to be made and all of the crap that goes along with that. So that in many ways is the legacy of the 70s in the music of the way the decade rang in with years like 1971 with just wall-to-wall phenomenal records, and the way the 70s came to a close with plenty of great records, but there was so much more industry and commerce and big money and all of the negativity that can bring to the business. Hence the rise of things like punk as a reaction to a lot of that, which in turn gets co-opted like everything else.
Of course.
But that is part, I think, of what made 1971 such a magical year, is that the big money, the executives, the people who don't really know or care much about music hadn't got their teeth into it yet. There was still a certain amount of freedom and exploration that artists were able to make and to get away with. Just kind of, went away little by little as the years have gone on to get us to the point where we are now, where there really isn't a record industry anymore, not in the way there was in the 70s.
Very well put. And I think that sums up this era in the year thusly. And I think that's going to be it for this episode. Brad, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, the name of my podcast is the I'm in Love with That Song podcast, where we pick a song and do a deep dive into it each episode. You can find me on all the primary streaming services, Spotify, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, Pandora. It's all out there. You can find me on Facebook. Just search for the I'm in Love with That Song podcast and we'll come up. You can communicate with me there. And of course, visit the website where all of our previous episodes are available on the website, which is lovethatsongpodcast.com. Thanks.
Yeah. And I've listened to your show and you articulate your reasons for loving the song. And what comes across is your passion and your feeling for the music, which, I think, if you want to convince somebody of a song, you really need to kind of break it down like you do and just kind of get into the mechanic. I hate to say mechanics of it. That makes it sound a little, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah. I always try to avoid words like dissection because that sounds a little too clinical for what I'm trying to do. Yeah. You do not have to have any musical knowledge or experience to enjoy the show. We don't talk about music theory on the show. We talk about production and arrangement and, things that I think that any casual listener will understand and appreciate. But, I don't go into each episode knowing everything. That's not what it's what it's about. Right. Each of my shows start with me listening to a song that I love, thinking about it. It just a song comes on and I think, that's a great song. How did that song come to be? And so it's me discovering it along with you, the audience. I do lots of research and we spend a lot of time listening to individual tracks of the song, but it all starts with me trying to discover more about, why do I like this song? What about this? Why does this song work so well?
Right.
And that's really what the song is about. It's about the discovery or rediscovery of this music that we all love so much.
That's awesome. It was great having you on the show, Brad, and we'll have to have you come back again sometime to talk a little further. And
sure, I'd love to do it.
Yeah, no, this was a lot of fun. And right now I'm kind of scrambling to find, different guests for different episodes. So I'll probably be calling on you in the near future to come back and do another show.
I'm always willing. Yeah, time and and life allowing, I'm happy to come back and do it. One other thing, if I don't know if you have any listeners in the Nashville, Tennessee area, but I will be at the Rockin' Pod Show,
nice.
Which is a convention, an expo for podcasters. There's also plenty of rock musicians, famous and semi-famous musicians there, and lots of podcasters. Yep. If you'd like to come by and say hi, a lot of the other shows you know and love will probably be represented there too. So support your podcasters. Excuse me. Come out for the show. It's in August. You'll find, just search for Rock and Pod, and I'll be there. And it'd be loved to, be a pleasure to meet any of the listeners. So come on down.
There's some great people involved with that. I mean, Ken Mills has been the driving force behind this. He's, of course, the pod father, our pod father. Chris Sinzak, of course, of Decil Geek. You know, all, you know, and all these people are just great people. They're, you know, people who have really contributed to my love of music and in some cases maintaining it, because they just, you know, talk about what they love and it shows. And with that, we're going to end this episode. We'll see you next time, and take care.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Mr. K's Super Show. If you like what you heard, please write a review on Apple Podcasts or on Podomatic, and share us on Facebook, Twitter, or the social media of your choosing. The Mr. K Super Show, copyright 2021, all rights reserved.